Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. The overwhelming success of last year's Women's March on Washington demonstrated the rise of the feminine energy in the collective unconscious of humanity. And not before time, for as today's guest, Lama Sorchim Alione, asserts, the suppression of the sacred feminine and the loss of feminine qualities is an urgent psychological and ecological issue in modern society. And it is only by empowering the sacred feminine and by listening to the earth as she tries to communicate with us that we will ultimately heal ourselves and the planet. Lama Sorchim Alione is a celebrated Buddhist teacher and spiritual activist, the founder and resident Lama of Tara Mandala Retreat Center in Colorado. She's the author of Women of Wisdom and the national bestseller Feeding Your Demons, Ancient Wisdom for Resolving Inner Conflict, which is now translated into 20 languages. Lama Sorchim Alione joins me now to discuss her latest book, Wisdom Rising, Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine, which provides a method for inner transformation and empowerment into wisdom and fierce compassion for all of us, women and men, who want to be a part of the rising awareness of and the return of the sacred feminine. Lama Sorchim Alione, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, your life journey has been a far from ordinary one. You were born in New England to an academic and publishing family. You travelled to India in your late teens. And in 1970, at the age of just 22, you were ordained as the first American Buddhist nun. You were also recognised as the reincarnation of a renowned 11th century Tibetan yogini and became one of only a few female lamas in the world today. Tell us a little bit about what first attracted you to Tibet and to Buddhism.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because I think it was really the mandala that drew me in. I met the mandala on the book cover when I was about 15, maybe 16 years old. My grandparents lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was in Harvard Square and wandering around and went into a bookstore, and there on a table in front of me, I can still see it in my mind's eye, was this book by Carl Jung with mandala on the cover, Tibetan mandala. The mandala, just so your listeners know, is a round and circular shape divided into four quadrants in the center, and the Tibetan mandalas are quite elaborate, and they're meditation tools. And so I didn't know any of that at the time, and I just looked at this Tibetan mandala on the cover of this book, and it was as though I traveled into the mandala right there in the bookstore, and I thought, this is not normal art. There's something going on here. And I ended up buying the book, and there were other mandalas inside, and also Jung's discussion of the mandala, and the mandala being found in, like, the Rose Windows in Chartres and other Gothic cathedrals and so on. And so I sort of literally followed the mandala and went to India and Nepal when I was 19 and met the Tibetan people, and I was a painter at the time and wanted to learn to paint Tibetan mandalas, and learned that it would take probably about a year just to learn how to measure one, and that was kind of discouraging, so I didn't end up doing that. But I did return in 1970, having been at Sami Ling, which is a Tibetan monastery in Scotland, been there for 6 months, and then went back and went to Nepal, and I was ordained in January of 1970 as the first American Tibetan Buddhist nun.
When you saw the mandala for the first time, did you feel any sense of recognition?
You know, I wouldn't have known to call it that at the time, but I would say in retrospect, yes, because it was that feeling of, I know this, or like trying to remember something, but I didn't even really know about past lives at that time. So it was more just a feeling of incredible attraction, and that continued to be extremely strong when I met the Tibetan people. And it was like a homesickness that I hadn't known that I'd had until then.
Mm. Yeah. I watched a documentary about you, Feeding Your Demons, and in it you were describing yourself as having been quite a wild child. You were always out in nature, riding your pony, swimming in the lake, sometimes on the back of your pony in the lake. And one of your greatest pleasures was to run outside in the middle of a thunder and lightning field storm in your swimsuit. Now that speaks to me of a personality that really reveled in movement and action. And yet, when you became a nun, you spent 4 years living in caves and remote retreat huts practicing meditation. How difficult was it for you to adapt what appears to have been a wildly exuberant nature to one of stillness and contemplation?
Well, I was wild and very physical as a child. But, you know, Tibetan Buddhism has physicality in it, too. For example, the first thing I did was to do 100,000 prostrations, full-length prostrations, which are done with a certain visualization and something that you're reciting. So it's a meditation, but it's very physical because you slide all the way down flat on your stomach and then back up. And it takes about 20 minutes to do 100. And so 100,000 of those took me 3 months doing that nonstop, basically, all day. And there's that aspect of the prostrations, and there's also some yogic practices in Tibetan Buddhism. But for me, I didn't have any trouble at all in terms of the meditation and the long hours in meditation. Meditation for me was fascinating and deep and wide, and I didn't feel sort of restless or irritated by having to just sit there for hours. It felt very full and like a kind of inner exploration. And so I think it is past lives, you know. I have done this before, and I just never had been exposed to it. And so once I was exposed to it, it all came back.
Yeah.
Kind of like, if you smell something, and you know that smell, but you can't remember what it is. And then you find out, oh, that's banana bread, or, you know, something like that. And then you're like, oh, yeah, I like banana bread. I'm going to eat it.
Mm-hmm. Now, nonetheless yearned to become a mother, and eventually you renounced your vows, you returned your vows, as they say. How difficult a decision was that, and how did renouncing your vows impact your Buddhist practices, or did it not?
Yeah, that was a really difficult decision, because I was actually quite happy as a nun, very joyful. And it also felt like, as a nun from 22 through 25 years old, almost 4 years. And I felt that if I continued to be a nun, I would be repressing particularly my sexuality, and that wouldn't be actually healthy for me. And I also had a longing to have children that point, and I just felt that it had been an excellent thing for those years. And I talk about in my first book, Women of Wisdom, how it was a time of being a maiden or a virgin, not literally a virgin, but the time of for a woman to belong to no man. And
yes.
So I had had boyfriends and so on before, and then I was celibate for that time, and it was so good for me to pull out of that whole dynamic and really find myself and center in myself for those years. But then I felt it would become sort of a repression if I continued. And so that's why I stopped. But it definitely wasn't an easy decision to make.
No, I'm sure. Now, you subsequently became the mother of four children, one of whom, your daughter Kiara, died at just 2.5 months. And you write in your book that after you lost Kiara, you found courage again in female Buddhist role models, and you discovered a way to transform your pain into a path forward. What practice was the most helpful for you?
With the death of Kiara?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dealing with that pain and being able to move forward after it.
Yeah. Well, at that point, I was studying Dzogchen, which is the nature of mind practices. It's sort of the highest level of practices in the Tibetan tradition. And so that was helpful, this resting in the nature of mind. And then just being present with the grief. I guess you could call it a kind of mindfulness, but bringing myself into the grief rather than trying to escape from it, to really honor it and be a present with it as I could be, which is difficult, but in a way it's the running away from grief that makes it worse than just actually turning toward it and feeling it.
Yeah, I can imagine. In Wisdom Rising, you teach the mandala of the five dakinis, a practice that brings together sound, visualization, and meditation to help transform challenging emotions into their wisdom counterparts. Tell us about the dakinis. Who or what are they?
Mm-hmm. Well, the dakinis are embodiments of wisdom in the form of fierce and feminine beings. The dakini in Tibetan, the word is Khandral, which means sky dancer or she who moves through space. The Dakini is the most important manifestation of the feminine in Tibetan Buddhism, and she can appear in a lot of different ways. She can appear as a human being or as a deity, as she does in the Dakini Mandala. She's portrayed as fierce, surrounded by flames, naked except for usually something like a tiger skin and various ornaments, and she's dancing, and fierce. And so she's a form of the sacred feminine that we don't usually see. If we see the sacred feminine at all, we see a female figure usually who's motherly and compassionate and so on. And not this fierce, wild manifestation. And so the dakinis are that, and they're messengers of spaciousness, emptiness, and a force of truth. And one of the things that I say in my book is the dakinis preside over the funeral of self-deception. So they have a quality of sort of fierce truth and energy. And they're often, traditionally, they were found in charnel grounds or cemeteries, and also appear in visions at dawn or dusk when it's sort of the twilight time between the worlds. So it's a fierce feminine, but it's enlightened feminine. And I think the fierce feminine is something that men particularly have been very afraid of historically. And so it's not something that's been allowed. It's the fierce feminine has been the witch or the bitch. And So that's not true in Vajrayana Buddhism. There's this other aspect of the first feminine, which to me is really exciting and important at this time with women rising in their fierceness, that they have something they can identify with that's fierce compassion. It's not hatred. It's turning that anger into activism. And so the Dakinis provide a form of inspiration for what's happening now for women and their allies.
And each of the five Dakinis is associated with a difficult emotion, such as depression, mm-hmm. anger, arrogance, craving, or envy, as well as a corresponding wisdom energy. You know, that I guess that, you know, the whole point of it is to move from the difficult emotion into the wisdom energy side of things, such as yes. equanimity and discernment. How can they actually help us shift our emotional challenges into empowerment?
Well, the way the transformation takes place is essentially through sound and light and visualization. So those three components are present, and you work with the seed syllable of the Dakini, which is it's quite literally what the Dakini is born from, is that sound. And then through that sound and the color and then the symbolic meaning of the Dakinis and all their accoutrements and so on, you sound the seed syllable and then you actually become the Dakini. So you're her rather than seeing her as outside yourself. And so you start with the, let's say, the anger, some emotion, and then the emotion connected to that family is transformed through sound and color and visualization.
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest today is internationally known Buddhist teacher Lama Soltym Alione, whose latest book, Wisdom Rising, Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine, provides a method for inner transformation. We'll be back with more after this break.
The future of internet radio is here. Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Change and growth are part of natural life and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the Om Times Experts program. With Om Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Lama Soltym, in Wisdom Rising, you place your teachings in the context of recent feminine resistance, including the women's marches, the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movements. Your hope, you've said, is that Wisdom Rising can help readers respond with greater wisdom and effectiveness to the distress, challenges, and chaos of our global reality. You've had your own experiences of patriarchy in Buddhism. You were criticized by your Buddhist teacher for being too feminist, when actually you were only trying to bring balance to Buddhism. Tell us a little bit about how that experience shaped you.
Well, you know, when I began with Buddhism, I wasn't really aware of issues with women. I think because of being Western, I was given preferential treatment that a Tibetan woman wouldn't have gotten. In fact, I know that that's true. And but later on, after Kiara died, I became aware in a different way of this. In a way, it was like a blank in my world, which was, where's the feminine? What, you know, what would other women do who have lost a child, like had happened to me? What would other Buddhist women do, and where are their stories? And so that put me on the search for the stories of women. And in the process of writing the introduction to that book, my first book, Women of Wisdom, I researched women in Buddhism, and I found out about the sexism and the history of that in Buddhism, and then also became aware of ways it had worked in me. And I also got really excited about women's spirit, I guess you could say, a women's spirituality, and questions like, you know, if religion or spirituality were created by a woman, how would that be? How would that be different? And how would it be to be part of traditions where we were leaders and not just sort of allowed in under certain rules, which is true of all patriarchal religion, I think, in all the world religions, that women are very seldom in leadership roles. So the death of Kiara and searching for my own answers began my awareness about the feminine. And I actually, of course, it's upset about the sexism and so on in it. But also, I became excited about the feminine and feeling of, wow, this is like a whole half of humanity that we're not really fully experiencing in her full potential. And so that's really my effort in this latest book, in Wisdom Rising, is how can we bring the full potential of the feminine to bear on the current situation.
And do it in such a way that it isn't threatening.
And to really make the distinction between fierceness and hatred.
Yes.
And how do we take the anger? Because certainly there is righteous anger in women for what's happened to them over not just recent years, you know, centuries and centuries. And so there's that anger, but then how can we work with that energy and turn it into wisdom and transformation? So that's what I did in the book, was to offer tools for that transformation and inner empowerment, like empowerment, inner empowerment from which we can draw.
You know, what really struck me about your book, you know, I don't know too much about Buddhism. What little I know, you know, I've read the odd book here and there, you know, especially if I've been interviewing somebody, but I've never ever come across something like your book, because I really was riveted by the practicality. you know, the way that you've taken the five dakinis, you share the information about the encumbered emotions and how we can move beyond that and really use this in our daily life and transform mm-hmm. ourselves. I've never come across something like that before. Is that something that you have basically pioneered, that kind of interpretation in that practical
no,
way?
No, not really. No, it's traditional. You know, I think Trungpa Rinpoche was the first one to talk about the Buddha families in this more psychological way, and also describing body types and, you know, interiors and so on. He taught it in terms of filmmaking, and he taught how, you know, a certain shot in the film would be perhaps the Vajra family or Ratna family, and got people sort of seeing through that lens of the five families, which is what I did in the book, really make it personal. And you know, I talk about how each family would manifest at a party, you know, a person
yes.
from each family would manifest if they went to a party. And you know, to just bring it into something very practical and accessible. And I think that's really what I tried to do in the book, is make something that could be quite esoteric and perhaps difficult to understand into something very personal and accessible.
And you did it beautifully, because, you know, I was enjoying the book, but it was at that point that I started to get excited by it, because I thought, oh, here is something that clearly works. It is a practice that we can do. And the descriptions that you gave, you know, I loved the, you know, the Dakini at the party, the particular types. There's a colour and a body type, and as you said, a seed syllable, mm-hmm. and even, you know, exit strategies when we want to move away from something. Could you give us a little bit of a brief overview of, you know, the five types, just so that people can really tap into this and understand the significance and the usefulness of knowing this?
Yeah, sure. So the center of the mandala, and perhaps the listeners could place themselves in the mandala as I describe this. In the center of the mandala is the Buddha family, and this is the element of space. The color is white, and the emotional pattern is spaciness, spacing out, which takes the form of depression, in extreme forms, dissociation, procrastination, forgetting things, spacing out, essentially. And then the transformed emotion, which is the same energy as what I call the encumbered emotion. It's the same energy with a struggle of the ego removed from it. And so that transforms into spaciousness, the wisdom of space, of vastness. So that space E becomes spacious. So that's in the center, white. And then in the east, which you would see in front of you, in the mandala, the color is blue, the element is water, the encumbered pattern is anger, and the enlightened wisdom aspect is mirror-like wisdom. And so this is anger, but it's also, the Vajra people are very austere and scientific and a bit cold, unemotional, but very sharp. And so Steve Jobs is a really good example. Steve Jobs, who founded Apple, of a Vajra type. And he has that angular body and so on that the Vajra person has. So it's taking that clarity that can be tied with anger and sharpness and transforming that energy through the color and sound and so on into mirror-like wisdom, which is the mind as a mirror. In other words, that it has that clarity, a mirror, even a very small mirror, can reflect a huge landscape. And so our minds are very vast, actually, and we think of ourselves as limited, but in fact our minds are limitless and clear in their true condition. And so that's Vajra family, and that's in the east, and that's seen in front of you in the mandala. And then to your right is the south, and that's yellow, and it's the element of earth, and it's the encumbered pattern's kind of interesting because it's pride and arrogance, but an important piece of understanding Ratna family is it's actually a feeling of not being good enough and a kind of poverty mentality that creates the need to puff yourself up with pride and arrogance. And so the Ratna person tends to over-consume, overeat, overdrink, overshop, perhaps, accumulate things in extreme. It would be hoarding, and all with this feeling of there isn't enough, I'm not enough, and therefore I need more. And so that transforms into the wisdom of equanimity, unchanging stillness. So it's giving everything equal value so that you're not grasping at one thing and rejecting something else. There's an evenness in the wisdom aspect in the south. And then in the west is Padma family, that's behind you, and it's red and it's fire and it's lust, and desire is the obstructed pattern, and the wisdom is discernment. And so the encumbered Padma type is always seducing. Even the waiter or the person that's checking you in at the airport or whatever, the Padma person needs to have a relationship with them, needs to find out where they're from and how they are, and, you know, is sort of that need to connect. And, of course, we all have that need to connect. But in the Padma, it becomes kind of compulsive, and it turns into discernment, which is actually really interesting. How can this sort of compulsive desire become discernment? Well, when you are trying to seduce somebody, you become very discerning about them. You notice every little detail about them, and you relate to them with discernment. So when that neurotic pattern is transformed, the self-reference of seduction is removed, and it becomes compassion. So it moves from passion to compassion. And discernment, being able to see relationships of colors, of sound, of people, and so on, perhaps putting the right people in touch with each other, that kind of thing, but without the egoic reference point that we have in the encumbered aspect of Padma, which means lotus, by the way. And so that's the west behind us. And then in the north, we have envy and green, and that's to our left, and the element is air. The aspect that's under that envy is a feeling that somebody's getting ahead of us and we have to hurry up. So there's a kind of breathless competitiveness in the karma family, and can lead to workaholic tendencies. Overworking because of fear of being left behind somehow. And the karma person, if there's a party, they're afraid they're not being invited to the party of the A-list, that they're perhaps at the B party and they want to be at the A-list party. So there's a feeling of paranoia based on comparison. Mm-hmm. And then that wisdom is all accomplishing wisdom. And so that sort of force of compulsive activity becomes enlightened activity, and you move from the force to the flow. And so in that wisdom, you have a lot of synchronicity, and things just sort of falling into place when you get into the flow rather than the force with the karma family. So that's a little brief journey around the mandala.
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with internationally known Buddhist teacher, Lama Sautrim Alione, about her latest book, Wisdom Rising, Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine, which explores the principle of fierce compassion, the awakened feminine, and shows us how we can use this principle for positive change in our own lives and in the world. We'll be back with more from Lama Sautrim after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. Om Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single Om Times endeavor. Host your show with Om Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, you know your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Lama Sautrim Alione, you write in the book about creating Dakini mandalas, an altar, drawing a Dakini mandala, wearing the wisdom Dakini colour, all kinds of things that we can do on a very practical level ourselves without necessarily having to have some training in this to help us get beyond some of these patterns and encumbered emotions and transform them. Would you be willing to give us a little example of a practice that you write about in the book, perhaps working with a seed syllable to transform an encumbered emotion or something like that?
Yeah, so do you have a particular one of the five emotions that you would be interested in trying?
No, because quite honestly, I was riveted by all of them and saw myself in everyone.
Okay, well, let's try the Padma family. Padma is that compulsive need to seduce, or that longing for union. Longing for the partner, the perfect person that's going to make us feel whole. And so that creates a kind of compulsive seduction pattern, which it may not be extreme in that sense of compulsive seduction sounds pretty intense, but just a longing that we might have for that unification with the other, and a feeling if we could just find the right person, it would everything would be fine, everything would be perfect. So what I would suggest is as we listen here, to try to feel that pattern in yourself, and how does that live in you, and where does it live in your body, if you think about that longing for union Where do you feel that? Personally, I feel it in my heart area. Can you feel where you feel it?
I feel a constriction below my heart, more in the kind of, the gut.
Plexus?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That's the center of the body, really. So finding that, and then we'll try working simply with the seed syllable and the color rather than the full visualization of the Dakini. So take a moment and feel into that feeling of longing, noticing how that feels in our bodies and where. And then we'll sound the seed syllable of the red Padmadakini, and we'll see as that happens, as we sound the seed syllable, we'll see the color red going through our body and sort of lighting it up with bright red luminosity. And so as we sound the seed syllable, we'll just sound it once, and sounding it inwardly as rather than projecting it out. So the difference would be the seed syllable is ni, N-I, and so rather than something, it would sound something like ni, it would be more ni. Almost making your body like a chamber where the sound is resonating, because you're actually working with the sound to transform the emotion. So we'll try that now. The sound ni and the color red, the red light going through our body. And to begin with, again, attuning to the emotion so we can actually feel the transformation take place. And notice the feeling of the red in your body. So could you feel a transformation take place?
It was interesting because what I could feel was almost as if there was a fragmentation taking place of, you know, this red area in my body, as if it was kind of breaking up.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, breaking up the solidification there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this can be done with anger, with that pride that I talked about, the arrogance, with the underlying feelings of inferiority, with the speediness of karma, and with depression, spaciness of Buddha family, and so on. So you let the color go through your whole body, not only where you're feeling the obstructive pattern, but permeating your whole body. And in the Dakini Mandala practice, you actually, it does that, and then you transform into that dancing, in this case, brilliant red Dakini, and you become her. And so that's a whole other layer of symbolic meaning of what she's holding, of actually the embodiment of the fierce, wild, wise feminine. So that's this. What we just did was sort of a gateway practice, and then what you would do if you go deeper is to go actually into those five Dakinis.
The book is filled with many practical things that we can do, and also many stories of people who have you know, done this practice themselves, you know, religiously for a year or more, and noticed tremendous change within themselves. It always astonishes me when, you know, we can practice something with sound and colour, and it can transform something within us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you've recently announced the Wisdom Rising Mandala Training Program, so people can come to the Tara Mandala Retreat Center in Colorado and actually have training in this.
Yeah, and, you know, yesterday we launched the online program, which is 13 hours of material of me teaching and a couple of other teachers teaching. So people don't even need to come to Tara Mandala. I mean, we love to have people here, but it's nice that it can reach them in their homes. And not everyone can travel to Southwest Colorado. So
does that become a kind of self-directed course? You know, they can log into it whenever they want?
I'll be on it. They sign up and then they can take the different parts, when they want to. But then there's certain times when I'll be there, and then other teachers will actually be online to teach or to answer questions. So it's not completely sort of already existing online. It has a wide live component as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that just launched yesterday. It's called Wisdom Rising Online.
And at your Wisdom Rising retreats, you give the transmission for this practice. What does it mean to be given a transmission?
In this case, the teacher embodies the wisdom energy of the mandala during the transmission, and then that's transmitted through sound and through the mind to the participants, and they practice together, and it's in the experience of the practice together that the transmission takes place.
Wow. I want to return to the Women's March and the Me Too movement for a moment, because you wrote about something in Wisdom Rising that you had noticed that afterwards it was almost as if the energy and the cohesion and the momentum of the Women's March, you know, that energy began to dissipate in the weeks and months afterwards. And I've noticed many other people who've said the same thing. I was at the Sister Giant conference back in January, which was around about the same time, and there was tremendous energy in that room. And afterwards, again, you know, it dissipated amongst the people that I went with. And it seems to me that what you've done with Wisdom Rising is you brought out a book that really could become a kind of I hesitate to use the word Bible, but it's a rallying cry. It's given us the opportunity to take that energy and do something with it. It's given us a practical way to move forward. Are you finding that many people are also recognizing that in the book?
Yeah, people from all over the world, actually. The book is now already coming out in 5 languages in Europe. So it's not a uniquely American phenomenon, although the Women's March was triggered by an American event. I think that there's a longing for and a need for a deeper transformative practice, an inner practice to match the out-moving energy, in this case, of the women's movement and so on. What do we have to draw on internally? And so that it really goes beyond mindfulness and sort of those more simple kinds of meditation into very specific empowerment that is connected to the mandala. And we haven't talked so much about the mandala here today, but that's really important because the mandala, which is basically the circle with the four quadrants in the center, and in this case is the mandala of the five dakinis, these enlightened feminine energies, the very form of the mandala, the shape, the structure, the template, the blueprint that the mandala presents is a healing structure. It's a structure, the circle divided into the quadrants and with the center is found all over the world in many cultures. And so by placing your mind into the mandala, which has also, by the way, been proven in many scientific studies at this point to be effective in healing the mind and the emotions and people in trauma and so on. So that's another aspect that is in Wisdom Rising that is sustaining and healing for people to enter into the mandala and then to be able to draw from that energy of centering. And it's not merely centering because it's connected to these very powerful energies of the five dakinis. And so I think it's, you know, what I thought about, you know, and I was thinking about the mission of the book, I was thinking about what if all of those people who were at the march, which was apparently at least 5 million on 7 continents, what if all of them were doing the Dakini Mandala practice? What would that do to catalyze change and healing in our world? And so that's my mission, is to have all those people doing the mandala practices and having those resources to draw on.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, this time in the world where we're seeing the degradation of women, the domination of marginalized groups, the destruction of the natural world, mm-hmm. etc., that the fierce compassion that you write about of the Dakinis is needed more than ever. And it almost feels to me as though there is something other that is also driving this movement, so that our consciousness is awakened. You know, the yearning, as you talk about, is being stirred. You know, the fire's being stoked within us. And do you feel that the Dakinis, you know, are participating in this process?
Definitely, yeah, they definitely are. That it's an interesting thing that you said, that it feels almost like it's coming from somewhere else, or you know, why now?
Yes.
And it just seems like the moment has arrived, and I don't know why exactly. What happened, but it's happening in Buddhism too. There's a whole Me Too movement in Buddhism now, and that actually started before the Me Too movement in Hollywood and that whole thing that happened at the end of last year. So it seems like this moment has arrived where the tables are turning and the feminine is stepping up. Some people say it's because there's enough women in positions of power, and that something like if you have 20%, for example, of Hollywood producers are women, then you'll see a shift. And so it may be something like that. It's just a matter of numbers and the gradual change and then change and then sort of a flip taking place, or who knows what. But it certainly is happening, and the Dakinis are certainly a resource from which we can draw, and you know it's generally something like the Dakini practice would be quite secret, and you wouldn't get it so easily. But I decided to put it out there in this sort of simplified form because I think these are urgent times, and we need to pull out all the stops and give the resources that we can to the world. Because the speed of destruction is increasing so quickly.
It is, and the urgency, the sense of urgency, even if people really don't know what they're feeling and why they're feeling it, it is there and it is palpable. I want to close with something that you wrote, which you know, I thought was wonderful. you know, and I wanted to make sure that it came across to our listeners. You wrote that this is a moment in history when we've been called upon to manifest the wisdom of the empowered feminine, which, as we've seen, is historically respectful of the natural world, understanding the interdependence of humans and the world that surrounds us. And since the destiny of women and the destiny of nature have always been parallel, and since women are major proponents of ecological awareness, by women taking their power back and manifesting it in the world, our ecological situations will be subsequently transformed, bringing balance, generating healing, and producing a culture of peace. That is a beautiful statement. It's a beautiful vision. How hopeful are you that we can and will achieve this?
Well, I tend to be optimistic. It's certainly lots of things to be pessimistic about, you know. But I there's a story of someone in Tibet who was building stupas, these big reliquary structures, as the Chinese were sort of on the other side of the mountain destroying them. And somebody said, why are you doing this? They're just going to take it down. Like next month, this will be gone. And he said, it's in the act and the effort of doing it that the blessing and importance is.
Lama Sorcha Malione, I wish we had more time to talk. I think your book is absolutely fabulous and I would recommend it highly to anybody. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Wisdom Rising, Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine is published by Simon & Schuster. And for more information about Lama Sorcha's upcoming retreats and the Wisdom Rising retreats, go to taramandala.org. And you can view the video trailer of Wisdom Rising at wisdomrisingbook.com. That's all for me today.